that's what Vince McMahon does better than anybody else, really, is listen to the audience. And even though our fans will respond, you don't listen. Yeah, okay, we do. It may not always happen immediately. It might take us some time to play things out creatively, but we are listening always.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 564 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Hell in a Cell Sunday, September 16, 2018. I am the Solid Monster. I want to just wish good thoughts to everybody who lives in the Carolinas, either North Carolina or South Carolina. Anybody who has been in the path of what was Hurricane Florence, now downgraded to a tropical storm. I know it's been wreaking havoc down in that region. And I know we have at least a few listeners living over there. So hopefully if you are hearing this, you are safe and your home is safe and everything is okay. Because that looked like a very scary storm. All these storms are scary. It's that season. I'm sure it's the first of many more to come. I noticed also before we get into everything here, and there's a lot to get into. There's been a lot to get into. There's even more to get into this week. And I've sort of reached my breaking point in many ways with Monday Night Raw. So I'm letting you guys know right now, I got a lot to say about just that and the state of the company. And we'll get to all that before Hell in a Cell predictions here in a second. But I did notice that Matt Hardy has spoken, the Woken One has spoken about his future. He wrestled last night at a house show in Corpus Christi, as I like to call it, Corpus Christi, Texas. And was filmed backstage, and without actually coming out and using that word and saying it outright, basically alluded to retiring by saying that this would be the final appearance of the Woken Matt Hardy character. And he said it's time for him to go home. And he tweeted later on, he said, you know, I have to go home to be a father, to be a husband. I did so much more than I ever imagined doing in this industry. Thank you for making this incredible journey with me. I love you all. If you watch the video, he specifically mentions Woken Matt Hardy as basically being retired. And also says never say never in terms of coming back. So, you know, it's made to sound as though that was his final match last night. I don't doubt that it probably is his final match for a while. I don't buy for a second that that's the last time we're ever going to see Matt Hardy in a ring, WWE or otherwise. And it probably is the final time we will see him as Woken Matt Hardy. But I am positive that we will see him wrestling again, even if it's just sporadically, and that we have not seen the last of Matt Hardy in the ring, but probably as a full-time performer we have. He's been doing some work behind the scenes, learning the ropes in terms of producing and things of that nature. So I don't know if he's going to end up being a producer or an agent. From everything that people have said about Matt Hardy over the years, I think he could probably contribute a lot creatively. Of course, the issue there is you've got one person basically in charge of creative, and that's the only person whose decisions really matter. So I don't know if Matt would fit into that environment, but he certainly seems to be a creative guy, and he could have a future in that respect. So anyway, we'll see where he ends up and what he ends up doing. But do I think that that was the last Matt Hardy match? No, I don't. Also, keep plugging away on Audible for those of you who have been supporting the podcast. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster is our link. If you use that link to sign up for a 30-day trial of the service, you get to pick one free audiobook of your choice that you get to keep no matter what. And so it could be a wrestling book, it could be a non-wrestling book, it could be an educational book, it could be a novel, whatever floats your boat. Use our link. You help out the show when you do. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster. They've been a very good partner of this show for a very long time. Thank you also to everybody who made a donation via PayPal. You guys know you can always do so on thesolomonster.com. The PayPal button is on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on this show. I want to say thank you this week to all of our loyal VIPs, including Chuck Lunatic Lentz, who's been a listener of the show for quite a while, as has Deadpool, James Herrera, Brandon the Galactical Garrel, who wants to give a sound-off shout-out to his wife, Clancy. Their one-year wedding anniversary is coming up on Tuesday, so congratulations to the happy couple. John Loose Cannon Lopez, the Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Show-Off Corey Van Dam, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, Aim for the Head Andrew Jorlog, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, Downtown Kenny Brown, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Renton Road Warrior Taylor Schatt, the Portland Pop Star Paul Hamilton, Glory Hound Keith Doherty, man, this is going to be psyched up for the Royal Rumble now, the Reno Renegade Wayne Ashanti, Dr. Happy Craig Kirkendall, the Bakersfield Brawler Kevin Velato, who is one half of the sibling Psychos, a very happy 17th birthday to Kevin. From me and his brother, Max the Axe. The two of them are spending the weekend at the Battle of Los Angeles. I'm jealous. I keep hearing nothing but great things every year about Bola. It's one of those sort of bucket list wrestling things. Hopefully one day, kind of like going to a Lucha Underground taping. Or going to the Tokyo Dome. I would say of those three, I'm probably more likely to go to the Tokyo Dome in the next 5 years than anything else. Ray Kaufman, Reggie Davis, and Cece, who goes by the Twitter handle at NothingVNothing. I want to send my thanks to each of them for dropping a 5-star review for the podcast in iTunes. I did mention last week, if anybody leaves some love in iTunes, ranks the show, leaves a review for the show, I would give you guys a shout-out here. That still applies. You just got to let me know if you do so. So I want to say thank you to them. And lastly here, Nick Frinka and his wife, Terry Louise, have been fans of this podcast for about 7 years now. I've shouted them out on here before a time or two. The very first email that Terry ever sent me was May of 2012. So they've been listeners for a while now. And Terry battled cancer for a long time. She was first diagnosed 2 years ago. We would talk online occasionally. She would reach out to me to check in to see how my mother was doing with her own cancer battle. And then I would check in with her to see how she was doing. Cancer took my mother from me in March. And I found out this week that cancer just took Terry as well. And she fought literally to her very last gasp. Nick shared with me a lot of the personal, you know, details about what happened this week. And all I can say is that nobody should have to suffer on their way out the way that she did. So my condolences to Nick and to their 3-year-old little girl, Kenzie. Terry had a mantra. Feel it on the first is something she would like to say. It's a message that she wanted to spread for both men and women, to check for abnormalities of any kind on the first of every month. Anything at all unusual on your body, feel it on the first, she would say. And if you find something, it's like here in New York. They have this campaign on the subways. I'm sure if you live here, you've heard it. This ad campaign. If you see something, say something. I say, why should it be any different for your own health? Right? Early detection is the key for a lot of these illnesses. Some of them, not all of them. But please get yourself checked out if you notice anything wrong. If there is any message to communicate from this, I think that would be the one that she would want to get out there. There is a fundraiser on GoFundMe. You can find the link on the Facebook page that Terry had set up called Fight Mama Fight. I think it'll come up as one of the top 2 or 3 results if you just type that into the search box on Facebook. This is to help assist with the $20,000 or so in medical bills that Nick and Kenzie now have to contend with. So if you'd like to contribute, you can look up Fight Mama Fight on Facebook, or you can find the campaign directly on GoFundMe. I just don't have the title for it, so that really is the best place to go. But again, my condolences to Nick and his family. Before I get to my Hell in a Cell predictions, I want to talk about Raw and SmackDown real quick. I'm not reviewing them because, A, you know, there's a pay-per-view tonight. It's kind of pointless now, but it's really just not worth your time or mine to get too deep into the shows from this past week. But there are a few things I wanted to get off my chest. One of those things being how unbelievably difficult it has gotten to sit through Monday Night Raw. And I know this has been a recurring theme for a while. This is not breaking news, but it just seems to be getting worse and worse. Even SmackDown, I gotta say, which generally is better than Raw, even SmackDown this week was a chore to sit through. But Monday Night Raw is just in a league of its own when it comes to boring, repetitive, uninspired television. And I look at the talent that they have on that roster, and I just ask myself, how? How can it be this bad, creatively speaking? How is it possible? How is it possible that this show opens with The Shield coming out to brawl with Braun Strowman and Dolph Ziggler and Drew McIntyre and Kevin Owens and Jinder Mahal, just like they did to open the show the week before? How is it possible that we get Ziggler and McIntyre against the B-Team, just like we did the week before? How is it possible that we get Bobby Roode and Chad Gable against The Ascension, just like we did the week before, right on down to the exact same two people with the exact same finish? When the first half of that show was over, I thought I had accidentally pressed play on the DVR for the previous week's episode. And then I realized I already deleted the last week's episode. This is new. Why even bother watching? I put the Raw poll up on Twitter, as I do every single week, as soon as the show was over. I got almost 4,000 votes. You know, when you hear about these political polls before elections, they do these phone polls. They could be polling 300 people, 500 people, maybe 1,000. You know, that's generally the sample size. I got 4,000 responses to this poll. Only 10% thumbs up. From those who watched, 56% of you said you did not even watch the show. SmackDown this week wasn't much better. 29% of you voted thumbs up, 15% thumbs down. Again, 56% of you did not even watch the show. That is remarkable consistency, by the way, on the number of people who did not bother watching either show. It just happened to fall that way for both shows this week, back to back. 56% did not watch. When 56% of people are not even making an effort to watch your show anymore, that's a problem. Kevin Owens, you have on this show, doing his best George Costanza impression. He quit on television a few weeks ago. He quit his job, only to show up for work the very next week and give it the assist to Braun Strowman, of all people. He comes out last Monday, he says, Baron Corbin called me up and begged me to come back and said I could do whatever I want. And I hate The Shield, and that's why I came out to help. So that's how they're now trying to spin this whole thing. If Kevin Owens can't be held responsible for his actions going forward, which is what he said Corbin promised him if he came back, then he should hide out underneath the ring tonight and cost Braun Strowman his Money in the Bank contract for all those months of abuse. He doesn't have a match on the show. He's got nothing better to do. At least that would make sense. Then on SmackDown, a rare Asuka sighting. I hear there's only three of them left in the world. They're on the endangered species list. And one of them is being held in captivity in catering on SmackDown. But there she was on Tuesday, in a backstage segment with Naomi, talking about the Iconics, and Naomi tells her to feel the glow. And Asuka says, I go. Because you see, Asuka no speak English. That's funny. At least the Nakamura stuff really was funny because you knew he spoke English and he was only pretending because he was being a dick. But here we are. We knew this moment would come where they mocked Asuka's accent and they used her for comedy. Then she said some stuff in Japanese and Naomi thought she was talking about teriyaki. The WWE creative team, ladies and gentlemen, hard at work. What a year it has been for Asuka. After losing to Charlotte at WrestleMania, losing the streak, she feuds with Carmella, loses to Carmella, then goes missing, and finally reappears just in time to grab dinner at the Japanese steakhouse. 56% of you not watching the show. I can't imagine why. You know, Batista had a sad tweet this week. He tweeted that he wasn't invited to SmackDown 1000 next month, which is in his hometown of Washington, D.C. Now, it's still a month away. They could still invite him, but he's very upset by this. Why would he even want to be on this show? Why would he want to have anything to do with this show? This is what happens when you get $1 billion for a TV deal. You have no incentive to change because you just made $1 billion. So why change anything? You know what else is worth $1 billion? The Cleveland Browns. And they're hard to watch too. Now I know there's a lot of people wanting my thoughts on the comments that Stephanie McMahon made this week at the Sports Business Journal's Game Changers Conference. And what the audio that you heard there, the little audio at the beginning of the show, that was from a different interview she did. This is not the first time that she's made comments to the effect of Vince McMahon, better than anybody, she says, listens to his audience. So that was from a different interview. But she was at this conference this week. And at this conference, she said, and I quote, "We're successful for one reason only. We listened to our audience." Note the past tense, by the way. We listened to our audience. Then about the women's evolution, she said, "You have to listen to your audience. Their voice matters." I will say, this week, of all weeks, was not the time for her to make comments like that. Not coming off that horrendously dull television show on Monday night. And if you just look at her comments through the prism of storylines and characters and who's a heel and who's a babyface and things like that, then she sounds absolutely delusional. You know, for years I had a nickname I used for Dixie Carter, and that nickname was Delusional Dixie, because everything out of that woman's mouth when it came to TNA or WWE was completely delusional. In fact, there was one point where she thought, seemingly realistically thought, that, hey, maybe we'll have like a working relationship with Stephanie and WWE. The woman was delusional. She didn't know any better. She was living on a different planet, Planet Dixie, located on the outskirts of the WWE universe. But I hear comments like that, and I'm reminded of Delusional Dixie. But here's the thing. I don't think, and why I'm not going to rip them apart, you know, the comments she made, not as much anyway, some other people have. I don't believe she was making those comments about storylines or characters. It was a business conference. So if we're talking about the women's movement in the company, and there has been a women's movement in the last 3 years or so, right? Ever since AJ Lee spoke up. It's not because of the Bella Twins. It's not because of Stephanie McMahon. I mean, collectively, they all played a role, but it was because of AJ Lee. It was because of the comments that AJ Lee made. There has been this movement with the women since then. So when you think of it in terms of that, and the Mae Young Classic, and the new UK show that they're putting together, and the whole WWE network, and the surveys about programming that we'd like to see on the network, then yes, they do listen to their audience. She is not wrong in that respect when she says something like that. However, the panel that she was on was called Storytelling in Sports Business. And for a company that loves to tell stories, and for stories, you need good characters that you could invest in, right, and get behind. When it comes to listening to their audience, this is why people get so upset when they hear comments like that. There is a difference between listening to your audience and actually doing what they want you to do. Oh yeah, I'm sure they listen. I'm sure they listen. They each have two working ears on their head. They hear the crowds, who they cheer, who they boo. They read the feedback they get. Of course they listen. They have survey data. But what do they do with that data? Yeah, I remember reading many years ago the WCW and the waning years of WCW. So we're talking the very end of the 90s, probably like 2000, around then. They commissioned surveys. They wanted to find out what it was that the audience wanted to see, why the audience was leaving, you know, different questions like that. They did surveys of their own. What did they do with that survey data? They threw it away. They completely disregarded it. Now, I'm not saying that that's what WWE does, but I'm saying there's a difference between listening to your audience and actually taking action and following up and doing things that the audience would like to see. Because at the end of the day, with this company, they're playing and serving to an audience of one. They're serving an audience of one, and that is the only voice that matters, and anybody who tries to argue differently is lying to you. So I can't honestly say that I know what Stephanie was referring to exactly when she made those comments, although I think it was about the women's stuff and all that, because there are, in fact, like I just outlined, examples of WWE listening to its fans. You cannot just say WWE never listens, because that's not true. But when it comes to their television shows and the week-to-week stuff, I don't see how you can make those comments with a straight face. Yes, catering to the kids has made them millions. Bringing in people like Ronda Rousey, by the way, also helped a lot when it came to those big fat new TV contracts they just signed. But the stock is soaring. I think it was almost at $90 at the end of this week. The company's worth something like $7 billion at this point. They're running 3 to 4 stadium shows every single year now. They are a very successful company in a lot of ways. But there is a vocal segment of their audience, of which we are all part. Everyone listening within the sound of my voice, I don't know what that percentage is, if it's as low as 10%, is it 20, 30, 40%, whatever it is, that wants to like these shows. There are people out there who just want to hate on everything and will shit on it no matter what. I don't believe that's a large enough segment of the wrestling population to matter. I think by and large, people want to enjoy themselves when they put these shows on and they sit and watch them, much like they did many years ago. They want to like these shows. They want to look forward to 8 p.m. on Monday nights again. They want to not fall asleep during these shows. Show more respect for those fans, instead of taking them for granted. Then you won't get laughed off social media for making comments like that. Now with that out of the way, now we can talk about Hell in a Cell, which takes place tonight from San Antonio, Texas. Renee Young officially replaced Jonathan Coachman this past week as a full-time commentator on Monday Night Raw, which means she will also be at the desk for the pay-per-view tonight. Coach will take over her old pay-per-view kickoff hosting duties. Renee is not as polished as some people might want her to be for that spot. I think she'll grow into it, and I think she's an improvement, a big improvement over Coach, who was awful. I haven't seen a coach this bad since Bobby Petrino. Okay, he was terrible. Renee is not perfect, but I consider this to be an upgrade. The other big news is that the Cell, and there are some people freaking out about this, but the Cell is now blood red. WWE live streamed the construction of the Hell in a Cell yesterday, and they are using a red cage now for Hell in a Cell. To that I say, if we're getting a red cell, then I demand that we get back the blue cage going forward for all steel cage matches. I think that's a fair trade. Bring back the blue bar cage. There is a whole generation of younger fans now who have no concept of the old blue bar cage. They'd probably look at it and go, what the hell is that? But actually, I think the blue bar cage is awesome, and I'd like to see them bring it back. And since it's blue, this is red, the cage is blue, I don't care if they just use it on SmackDown, that's fine. As far as what I think about the cell, I mean, we'll see it tonight, I guess, right? I don't know. I mean, I do remember the red cell with the top on it that TNA used. Was it the Asylum match they had? They may have only used it once on that one live episode of Impact at the beginning of 2010 when they went head-to-head with Raw. Jeff Hardy debuted. He was sitting on top of the cage. I thought it looked terrible. It was very hard. I mean, they had thick bars. It was very hard to see through. The color red, it just, you know, I don't know who made that choice. We'll see what this looks like tonight. At the end of the day, this company's got far more problems than the fucking color of the cage, so I'm not going to rant about it. I really just don't care. The kickoff match will be for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. This match was on the main card. It was bumped to the kickoff show as of Friday. It will be the New Day defending against Rusev and Aiden English, who beat the Bar last Tuesday to earn a championship match. I would love to see Rusev Day win the titles, but I think New Day retains. They just won a tournament for the titles. And plus, I figure Rusev and Aiden, they're going to, I know they've made up. Everything's all hunky-dory right now between them, but I still think they're going to be splitting up soon. And so perhaps tonight could mark the beginning of the end for this team. But I think New Day will retain. The Raw Tag Team titles will be up for grabs. Drew McIntyre and Dolph Ziggler defend against Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose. If Rollins and Ambrose win, that would make Seth a double champion, which would not be the first time he's done that. He has held the US and WWE titles simultaneously once before. They just put the belts on Dolph and Drew, and I don't think they're putting all of the gold on the Shield. I don't think they're doing the whole Horseman Evolution thing where all the belts go onto the Shield. So I'm going to pick Mick Ziggler to win. And I think Seth eats the pin from Drew McIntyre. So that sets up Rollins against McIntyre as a program going forward for the Intercontinental title. And maybe, just maybe, plants the first little seed of what will hopefully, eventually, be a savage turn by Dean Ambrose on his fellow Shield brother sometime down the road. Ambrose, by the way, did an interview this week with a newspaper in Texas where he claimed he almost died earlier this year after contracting MRSA in the hospital when he went in for tricep surgery. He had to be hooked up to IV antibiotics for a week in the hospital to get the staph infection out. But it was touch and go there, apparently, for a long time. Staph infections are no joke. You know, they're really not. I mean, WWE has its own little staph infection right now. But staph infections, though, are no joke. You want to hear about how horrible they can be? Go back and listen to the interview I did with Bob Holly a few years ago. And he talks about it in his book, too, The Hardcore Truth. You can get it on Audible. But if you go back and listen to the interview that I did with him, he goes into detail about how he almost lost his arm to a staph infection. So it's pretty crazy stuff. Charlotte defends her SmackDown Women's title against Stone Cold Becky Lynch. The most interesting of all the matches to me, heading into this show. How will WWE handle this? That is the question. They've done what they can to try to get the fans behind Charlotte as some sort of sympathetic character here. Repeatedly attacked. She was posing for selfies on Tuesday with fans at ringside, and she was viciously attacked by Becky Lynch, who was, you know, in the crowd as a masked fan. So they've done what they can to try to get people to sympathize with Charlotte and cheer for her and realize how evil Becky has become. But the fans are having none of it. I think this is the right time to do something of a double switch, which is actually a baseball term. I just can't say double turn. I can't even really call it a double turn, though, because I would not have Becky change much of what she has been doing, so much as I would change Charlotte's positioning as the sympathetic figure, right? I think they should go in the opposite direction with her and keep the belt on Charlotte a little bit longer and build to a stipulation match at Evolution next month where Becky finally wins the championship. So will they do that? Probably not. But either way, I think Charlotte is keeping the title here. And speaking of Charlotte, she was in attendance at her father's wedding this past week. I believe this is number 5, I think. Wife number 5 for the Nature Boy, Ric Flair. It's like handing out title shots, right? At some point, you've got to win one, right? Hopefully this one sticks for him. He and his new bride, Wendy Barlow, they've been together for about 6 years now. She was a valet for him when he was back in WCW. When he came back to the company in 1993, he had that Flair for the Gold show, and she was a valet for him. She was Fifi the Maid. And then they lost contact for many years, and they sort of reunited a number of years ago, and they've been together ever since. Now listen to this guest list for this wedding. This is amazing. This was a partial guest list for this wedding. The Undertaker was there, of course, with Michelle McCool. Michael Hayes, Fit Finlay, Dolph Ziggler, Shane Helms, James Storm, The Rock's mother, Conrad Thompson, who's marrying one of Flair's daughters soon, and Dennis Rodman. What a crew that is. Rick walked down the aisle to the rap song, Ric Flair Droop, or Drip. Is it Drip? I think it's Drip. I'm sure there's a lot of things drooping on Ric Flair these days. I think it's Ric Flair Drip. But the absolute best part of the entire thing was a photo that show, and I don't know where, it was on Twitter. There were a whole bunch of wedding photos that got posted somewhere. I found this one on Twitter, so you can search for it. But it's a photo that shows The Undertaker double-fisting two shots of whiskey in one hand. Because when you're The Undertaker, you can do that sort of thing. And that shirt that he's wearing this button-down shirt, jeans. This needs to be his new gimmick. Seriously, go take a look at these photos of what this guy was wearing. Fuck the dead man, fuck the American badass, fuck Master of Pain and Mean Mark. We need Club Undertaker. Clubbing Undertaker, that's what we need. Double fisting with one hand. Triple H doesn't stand a chance next month. Daniel Bryan and Brie Bella take on The Miz and Maryse. I think this either ends in a disqualification win for Bryan and Brie or a submission win for them, with probably Brie tapping out Maryse to the S-lock. I say this because, you know, Bryan lost the singles match with Miz at SummerSlam. I think he and Brie get the win here. That leads to Miz beating Bryan again because they're scheduled to face each other at the Australian show next month. And I think Miz wins that match. And as per the stipulation of that match, he then earns himself a WWE title opportunity in the future. And then they can get away from the feud for a few months and come back to it, maybe in time for WrestleMania. I still see that as the long-term direction here. So I'm going to go with Bryan and Brie. Ronda Rousey defends the Raw Women's Championship against Alexa Bliss. I don't know who in their right mind thinks Alexa is getting the belt back. Even Buddy Murphy put down some money in Vegas on Ronda winning this match. Ronda is my pick. And plus, you gotta keep Ronda strong for you-know-who, Nikki Bella. Right? I mean, that's apparently a big match they're gonna be promoting for Evolution, if the rumors are true. So I cannot see any circumstance in which Ronda loses the championship. Now, could she be disqualified? Could there be some kind of bullshit ending like that where technically Alexa wins? Yes. A DQ or a countout. But in terms of losing the championship, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And it probably is a case where, you know, we saw on Monday night Alexa's using her own version of an armbar. Maybe she gets Ronda in her own version of the armbar. Ronda laughs at her, easily gets out of it, uses one of her own to win. So anyway, a win for Rousey. And then we get to Jeff Hardy, the first of our two Hell in a Cell matches on this show. Jeff Hardy faces Randy Orton inside the cell. This match does not need to be inside Hell in a Cell. There is absolutely no reason for this to be inside Hell in a Cell. It literally only exists for Jeff Hardy to do some crazy spots either with the cage or off of the cage. That is it. That is the only reason that this is a Hell in a Cell match. We've seen Randy Orton inside the cell about 6 or 7 times in his career. For Jeff Hardy, this is his first, and quite possibly his last. I'm going to pick Randy Orton. I think Randy Orton gets the win. Jeff Hardy is only, you know, in storyline, Jeff Hardy is only the first in what Orton had said would be many people he would vanquish, who the fans like. So he'd be a big fat liar if he didn't win this match. So I'm picking Orton to win after Jeff takes some kind of spectacular bump and crashes and burns. What that bump is, if I had to guess, would be a swanton off the top of the cell. I think we're going to see a swanton bomb off the top of the cage. Orton moves out of the way, you know, Jeff crashes through some protective padding or some kind of rigged setup so he doesn't break his friggin' back. He did do an interview, and he said he plans to do something memorable that people will never forget. That is the only thing to me that would fit the bill that I could think of. Unless he goes heel, and just before he's gonna jump off, he kind of smirks and flips the crowd off, and then very gently climbs down the cell and walks to the back. That would be unexpected. But no, that will not happen. The bad part now, though, and him saying stuff like this, and just making this match Hell in a Cell, the bad part is that because he has promised this, and because everybody thinks he's gonna do something insane, if he doesn't, people are going to see the match as a disappointment. So if he does some kind of disappointing little dive, or doesn't do anything at all, if the match doesn't even, you know, spill outside of the cage, you have a situation where people are going to be like, eh, that's it? And they're actually going to come out of this thing disappointed. But like I said, that is the only reason for the cell to be involved here. There's at least one, if not multiple other matches on this card, even Charlotte and Becky, frankly. There are multiple other matches on this card with stories, personal grudges and stories going into them that would fit the bill better for this than this match would. And so because the cell and Jeff and people's expectations, they have to use it. At least we know WWE will cover his medical expenses, so that's nice. Samoa Joe challenges AJ Styles for the WWE Championship, one of the matches here that is more fitting of being inside Hell in a Cell, but is not. In fact, this has no stipulation at all. It's not been announced, to my knowledge, as no DQ or false count anywhere or something just to sort of spice things up a little bit. Nope, just a one-on-one battle. I am one of the many supporters of the Samoa Joe for WWE Champion campaign. I will proudly be the campaign chairman. Mic-wise, he is as compelling a performer as anybody on either roster right now. Match-wise, I think this will be very good. AJ is now nearing one full year since he beat Jinder Mahal to win the WWE Championship. I think it's now or never. I probably said the same thing before SummerSlam, I don't remember, but we had no clean winner at SummerSlam, right? It was a DQ finish. They cannot do the same finish 2 months in a row. I mean, I guess they can. I mean, look who we're talking about here, but they should not be doing a disqualification finish or some kind of bullshit finish like that back-to-back. I think that's what they did with Nakamura, actually, in some of their matches. But they can't do that here. If AJ does lose his composure, given how much Joe has been talking about his family and Wendy, this time I think it costs him, and Joe puts AJ to sleep. So my prediction is that Samoa Joe will win the WWE Championship for the very first time. I believe we are getting a title change here. This feud still has legs. It is too soon to blow it off. When AJ feuded with Nakamura, they had something like half a dozen matches. And Nakamura failed to win the title in every single one of those matches. There is nothing compelling about that when you wrestle a guy five times and you fail five times. Put the title on Joe and let AJ chase to get it back. And Braun Strowman finally cashes in his Money in the Bank contract against Roman Reigns for the Universal Championship, now with Mick Foley added as the special guest referee 20 years after he nearly killed himself inside and outside Hell in a Cell. Before I go any further, I have to plug this because it's one of the best things WWE has put together in a while. This did not air on TV. Maybe they'll show it on the kickoff show tonight or something, but probably not. It's about 15 minutes long. It's like a little mini documentary that WWE put together. It's on their website, and it is on their YouTube channel. And it is a video reliving the Hell in a Cell match from 98 between Undertaker and Mankind. And I know we've seen the footage dozens and dozens and dozens of times, and we've heard a lot of the same stories over and over again. This actually includes some nuggets that I think some people probably have not heard before. It has comments from Foley, and then on the phone, they did phone interviews with The Undertaker, who is completely out of character. It's not even The Undertaker, really. It's Mark Calloway, really, which is very unique. Hearing him in his normal voice, just talking about it like a normal person. They have Sergeant Slaughter as interview Tim White, who was the referee that night for the match. I'm trying to think if there was another... Oh, Jim Ross. And Jim Ross is also by phone interviewed. Jerry Lawler, who was there that night, was not interviewed for this, nor was Vince McMahon. So don't expect Vince to be commenting on it, or Terry Funk, or anything like that. But they have comments from The Undertaker and Mick talking about the match as they show footage. It's in real time as they go through it. And they just talk about, you know, Foley says, look, yeah, I did not climb to the top of the cage that afternoon. Vince McMahon had cornered him and said, look, have you been up there? And he lied to Vince and he said yes, and that was a lie. And Foley said, look, if I had gone up there earlier in the day, then this never would have happened. Because once he did get up there on the pay-per-view, he was terrified because he's afraid of heights. And so he would never have gone through with it. Undertaker talked about, you know, the injury he had at the time. Now, this I did know, and I don't know if it was a fractured ankle, a broken foot. He had some kind of a foot or ankle injury going into that match. That I do remember. A lot of people may not know that. Here they call it a broken foot. So think about that. Undertaker, you know, big dude. He's going into a match where, right off the bat, he has to climb 16 feet. He has to scale the side of this cage. He's a big guy. Undertaker's every bit of 6'10", 6'11". At that time, anyway, maybe he's shrunk a little bit, but he had to climb with a broken foot or an injured foot just to get to the top of the cage, not once, but twice, because after Foley took the bump and then Foley came back and climbed up, Undertaker had to climb right back up. He was already halfway down. Then the craziest thing, and I cringe when I watch this, but watch after Foley gets chokeslammed through the cage and Undertaker is just ominously standing above. Undertaker doesn't gently climb down the side of the cage and walk back in through the door. He basically climbs down through the hole in the cage and he falls down, lands on his feet, but he lands right on the ankle. And you can see after he lands, he's sort of favoring the ankle. I'm sure that must have hurt like a bitch. So, you know, he to think that he went into that match with an injury like that, because everybody talks about Foley, obviously, and everything he went through. It's just insanity. It's absolute insanity. But it was very well done. I think you'll enjoy it, especially the comments from Undertaker, because he even says in the video, I'm generally a very guarded person. There's maybe 15 people in the world who I would talk to about stuff like this. You know, he's very open. And I think it's just a very well done piece. So you should all go online and check it out if you haven't seen it. But Foley is going to be the guest referee 20 years later back inside the cell. He showed up on Raw Monday night and said that Stephanie McMahon, he went to her to ask if he can somehow be involved in the show. And she made him the special referee. The same man that she publicly fired and humiliated on TV last year and talked about what a horrible job he did. She seemingly had no problems making him the guest referee for the show. Or for the match. Foley had a little spring in his step. He's had a hip replacement. He's lost a ton of weight doing the DDP yoga stuff. So he looked good. I'm not saying that he should be taking bumps tonight, although I'm sure he will. He'll probably be shoved down or something. But he really should not be taking too much punishment, hopefully. This match I could see ending without a decisive finish. And I'm sure that would not send people home very happy. But they've done that before. You know, maybe they set up some kind of giant bump to end the show where both guys are laid out and neither man can respond. I think they turned Braun Strowman and they added all of the bells and whistles and, you know, Foley is ref, we'll put it inside the cell to distract from the fact that Braun Strowman is about to become only the fourth man in history to fail in cashing in Money in the Bank. If you count John Cena as being the first, I think generally people do, right? Even though he won that match against CM Punk on Raw 1000, he won that match by DQ. He failed to win the championship, so I say it counts. And so that would make... And then it was Damian Sandow, then it was Baron Corbin. I think Braun Strowman is about to join those ranks. Then again, it is absolutely possible that they put the title on Strowman. I'm not ruling this out. You know, there are people saying, of course, Roman is not going to lose. They just, you know, coronated him. They just put the championship on him. That don't mean that Roman can't lose the belt and chase for it. So it is absolutely possible they do a title change here. But if they do the finish that I mentioned with Joe in the WWE title match, I don't see them doing the same thing with Braun Strowman right after. So pick your poison. Does Joe win the title for, you know, the SmackDown title, or does Braun win the Raw title? Because I don't see both happening. You know, Mick Foley is the wild card here. His addition to the match feels completely unnecessary. You talk about tacked on and having nothing to do with the ongoing storyline. But I'd like to think he's in there to serve some kind of a purpose. And he's not just in there because, hey guys, it's been 20 years. Hi, I'm still alive. I'd like to think there's some kind of reasoning behind it. That's probably my first mistake, thinking that. But I think Roman Reigns retains. I think he holds on to the championship, but I genuinely do not know which way they're going to go with this. I am not a fan of what they've done with Braun. They had a guy in him that people genuinely liked and cheered for, and they messed with that because they needed a body to put in there with Roman. At the end of the day, it is all about Roman. He's the guy they've put all their eggs in that basket, and they're going with him. They're all in on him. He and Braun have had good matches before. Just because you may not be happy that Roman Reigns is the champion and what they've done with Braun doesn't mean that these guys aren't going to go out there and have a really good match. I think they will. So I expect this to be good, but I'm going to say no title change here and that Roman Reigns retains. So that is your full card as of right now. They could add something at the last minute. Like I said before, Kevin Owens doesn't have a match. You know, could they throw something on the kickoff show maybe with him and Lashley? I think it's possible. Either way, I will have a full review of the show up on YouTube later tonight. That's where you can find it. It'll be a Sound Off Extra exclusive. Hell in a Cell review up on the YouTube channel. Follow me on Twitter, too. I'll be live tweeting during the show. You guys can commiserate with me at Solomonster on there. And then you could check out the review on the YouTube channel later tonight. Speaking of cells and cages, I want to talk about MLW for a second here. I don't talk about them very often because I don't have a chance to watch their show very often. But MLW has a show called Fusion that airs on BeIn Sports, BeIn Sports USA, every Friday night. And I watched the show that aired on Friday night on BeIn. I'm shocked I even have that station. I have so many stations, I don't even know what they are. So apparently I have BeIn Sports. Tony Schiavone handles the announcing of the show, sometimes with Matt Stryker. This week it was Rich Puccini, the former Rich Brennan from WWE, who you may remember, he used to do commentary for NXT, a little bit for SmackDown. And before that, he was an announcer for Booker T's Reality of Wrestling. I enjoyed his commentary. I remember Rich being on commentary. I enjoyed his work. I guess the powers that be there did not. But they got to call, he and Schiavone got to call a War Games match this week, pitting the Babyfaces, which was Team Strickland, led by Shane Strickland, a.k.a. Killshot from Lucha Underground, who just got engaged this week, so congrats to him. John Hennigan, Tommy Dreamer, Barrington Hughes, or as I call him, Barrington Huge, and Kato Brazil. Against the heels, Team Callahan, led by Sammy Callahan, The Monster Abyss, Jimmy Havoc, Leon Scott, and Fulton, the former Sawyer Fulton from NXT. Look, with him, it's kind of a shame, you know, timing is everything. He was part of the original Sanity group. Now, maybe you look at Sanity now, and maybe he's like, boy, did I dodge a bullet there. But he was part of the original Sanity faction in NXT. Then he got hurt, like a month later. And they replaced him with Killian Dane. And then they released him. So that's what happens sometimes. Timing is everything. You get hurt. And you wonder why, like... And I'm sure it still happens today. But I know this was sort of an epidemic many, many years ago where guys would get hurt and they just wouldn't say anything. Or they would tape it up and just... And we're talking, like, serious injuries and muscle tears. And I'm sure there were guys left and right who just didn't say a word. Or downplayed the severity of the injury. And they just said, look, I got to make my shots. I got to, you know, I don't want to lose my spot. And, you know, years later, you wonder why their bodies are so broken down. But that's a great example of why. Guys don't want to lose their spot. And that's what happened to poor Fulton, who now just goes by that name. He is just, he is in MLW as just Fulton. This was two rings, side by side, like traditional War Games, enclosed in a cage, although like NXT last year, no roof on top. Team members alternated as they came out based on the winner of a coin toss, and it was no falls until all participants were called to the cage, and that is when the match beyond begins, and it is submission or surrender. For those of you wondering, how is MLW able to use the War Games name? Especially, you know, WWE, I thought they owned it. They have a War Games match now in NXT. They had one last year. They're going to have another one in November. How is this possible? It's possible because MLW owns the trademark on the name. Court Bauer got the trademark on the War Games name many years ago. In fact, during MLW's first run as a company, long before they were ever a podcast, they actually ran a War Games match. This was back around, I think when I looked it up, it was like 2003. They had a War Games match back then. So they own the trademark for it. Now, if you look at the way the WWE spells out their own War Games match, like what they did last year, it's all one word. Not so with the MLW spelling of it, which is two words. So that may be why WWE can use it. Either that, or maybe Court Bauer just gave them permission to do so. That might be the more likely answer. Because if you think about it, I mean, if I wanted to start my own promotion and have an event called WrestleMania, right? I don't think I would be able to say... I don't think I'd be able to call it WrestleMania by just dividing the two words. So I'm sure it's just a case where MLW just lets them use it. You know, they're not going to get into a whole legal pissing battle with WWE. So it's kind of cool, you know, that they have the rights to use it, and from the names of the two rings and everything, and the visual of it on TV looked really cool. What I thought was really cool about the whole thing is that, you know, you have a War Games match on free TV with Tony Schiavone on the call, just like the old days. I just thought that was so cool. But they were back here for the at the War Memorial Auditorium in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, building the Dusty Rhodes himself, the creator of the War Games match. He competed in the, when he was wrestling for MLW many years ago in that very building, Dusty wrestled. It's a very intimate little venue. So anyway, I'm sitting there and I'm like, all right, this is cool. War Games match, Tony Schiavone on the call. This is going to be really cool. The match itself I thought was okay. There really wasn't much in the way of drama. Yeah, maybe if I was more familiar with all the storylines and the whole Strickland versus Callahan feud, maybe I would have been a little more, into it. But it just felt like it was missing something. I mean, the action was good. The action was fine. The drawback, though, of seeing it on free TV are all the commercial breaks. So it actually may be better to watch on their YouTube channel. It is up there right now. But it was, it was not as good as the NXT version from last year. That was a much better match. But it was 30 plus minutes of mayhem. A lot of plunder, a lot of weapons, some of which were already in the ring when the match started. But you would expect that in a match anyway that has guys like Callahan and Havoc and Dreamer. And Abyss. Abyss was the final entrant into the match. Abyss came to the ring with his little pouch full of what else? Thumbtacks. And of course he took a bump on them. The babyfaces, shockingly, won the coin toss to give them the early advantage, but when Shane Strickland came out, he was immediately jumped by Sami Callihan, who tossed him off the stage. He bounced off a table. Callihan then powerbombed him through a table, and that was the last that we saw of Shane Strickland. He was helped to the back. He was never heard from again, which was kind of odd. No great valiant babyface comeback for, and he's the team captain, no less. So no, we never saw him again. It did give the heels the man advantage, which I assume is the reason, why they did that. The babyfaces later in the match, they wrapped Barrington Hughes in barbed wire. He said to them, "Wrap me up." And they wrapped him up so they could use him as this sort of walking barbed wire weapon. And I called him Barrington Hughes earlier because this guy is gigantic. I don't mean that he's tall. This guy has to be every bit of legit 450 pounds, maybe more. He is a big, big man. And so anyway, they wrap him up in barbed wire. He hits a corner splash on Fulton, wrapped in barbed wire. Then he hits him with a splash. And the baby faces basically give Fulton a version of an STF, but using the barbed wire around his forehead until he finally submits. Team Strickland gets the win, and then after the match, Sami Callihan blames Jimmy Havoc for the loss, and all the heels gang up on Havoc as they go off the air. I'll say this about MLW. The production values on the show are top-notch. There are some people who, they won't even bother watching anything other than WWE, because they just think, oh, it looks amateur and all that. This show looks good. You watch it, it just looks very, well-produced. They have a talented roster. They just signed up Brian Pillman Jr. to a 3-year deal, who looks so much like his father, it's scary. He even sounds like him a little bit too, just without all the raspiness. But I know they're teaming up at the moment, or he's teaming up at the moment with Teddy Hart. And actually there's a match coming up in a few weeks where it's going to be Brian Pillman Jr. and Teddy Hart, and I think Davey Boy Smith Jr. as the Hart Foundation. So there's sort of this new version now of the Hart Foundation in MLW, which is kind of cool. Low Ki is their champion. Pentagon and Phoenix are their tag team champions. Now, by the way, on Pentagon and Phoenix, since I talked about them a few weeks ago, now the belief is that they are in fact not going to WWE, and they are probably going to stay independent and staying with MLW through much of next year. Thank God for that, I say. Thank God for that. Them not going to WWE is some of the best news I read all week. I'm talking more so main roster, not so much NXT. But them signing with WWE and going to the main roster would be absolute death for those two guys. Maybe not their bank accounts, but they rule the roost right now. Those two guys on the indie scene, Pentagon and Phoenix right now, are on at least three different television shows, wrestling television shows in this country at the moment, all at the same time. Impact Wrestling, Lucha Underground, and MLW Fusion. And that doesn't even count whatever they're doing in Mexico. They don't need WWE. So anyway, MLW's got a good thing going right now. I think it's definitely worth checking out if you have access to it, which you do. You have access to their YouTube channel. Don't lie. Speaking of which, you can watch the full War Games match if you want to go back and watch it. It is on their channel. They post episodes online every Saturday. So the day after they air on TV, Saturday at 6.05 p.m. Eastern. Just like WCW's Saturday Night used to air back in the day on TBS. A booking sheet with the full card for next month's Evolution pay-per-view reportedly leaked online this week. And I say reportedly because there's been no confirmation. I mean, certainly not from WWE, but there's been no confirmation from any source that I would consider to be reliable, verifying that this is in fact a real leak. So I say that just letting you know that for the time being, this should be taken as just pure rumor and speculation at this point. The only two matches that are confirmed for Evolution so far are Trish Stratus against Alexa Bliss and Lita against Mickey James. Those are not the matches that I would have liked to see for each woman. I've already talked about this in recent weeks, you know, matching, you know, mixing in other names like Sasha and others. You could have had, you know, bigger singles matches, I think, for them. Honestly, I think it would be better if they just merged the two matches together. Mickey is with Alexa anyway, you know, and at least I think the idea of Trish Stratus and Lita teaming up together as tag team partners has some appeal to it. But anyway, these are the rest of the matches. These would be considered possible spoilers if this card turns out to be true. So if you don't want to know anything, and I will not mention what the Mae Young Classic finals are, but for everything else on here, if you want to avoid any potential spoilers, skip ahead 5 minutes. Just warning you now. Parts of this are already confirmed. Parts of this seem, you know, pretty plausible. And there's a few parts that sound very suspect to me. So anyway, for example, Naomi against Melina is one of the matches listed on this card. Melina has rarely, if ever, even been mentioned since leaving WWE. I don't know what the deal is with her and Victoria and WWE, but it's like they don't even exist. And Victoria, it's interesting, is not listed anywhere on this rumored card. But Melina against Naomi just sounds very, very random to me. A four-way with Rhea Ripley, Ginny, Killer Kelly, and Dakota Kai. Four women with zero exposure to the mainstream WWE audience. And barely even the NXT audience, which again is another red flag. Although it would make sense if you got some of these women on the show because it's an all-women show. And I could see them wanting to give some exposure to people at sort of the NXT level or the NXT UK level, of which I know Rhea Ripley is going to be part of that. The Riot Squad against Sasha Banks, Bayley, and Ivory. If this is the best that they could come up with for Sasha Banks for this big Evolution show, another match with the Riot Squad, only this time teaming with Ivory, then these people are idiots. Asuka is listed on here against Ember Moon. And this one I hope is true, because they had some great matches together in NXT. I think that could be really good. They have a Carmella talk show listed with members of the cast of the Netflix series Glow. You lost me at Carmella talk show. That sounds terrible. Alicia Fox and Kelly Kelly against the Iconics, against Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville, against Beth Phoenix and Natalya to crown new women's tag team champions. Women's tag team titles have been rumored for a while now, so it's no surprise. If they are going to debut them, Evolution would be the place to do it. And, you know, who would I put them on? Again, not necessarily the four teams that I would have put in a match like that, but of those four, honestly, I would put them on Mandy and Sonya. We'll have the finals of the Mae Young Classic, which I will not spoil for you. There is a 20-woman battle royal listed, with the winner facing Kairi Sane later in the show for the NXT Women's Championship, so that's two matches right there. Charlotte versus Becky Lynch for the SmackDown Women's title. And the main event listed on the card, Ronda Rousey defending her Raw Women's Championship against Nikki Bella, the longest reigning Divas champion of all time. So, I look at this card from top to bottom and I just think it's an underwhelming card if it is legit. I mean, there's some good things on there, but there's just so many other appealing combinations of matches. You would think for a first-time ever show like this, they'd want to hit it out of the park. I'm not saying you have to give away every single big, you know, big match, but, you know, for example, if they were going to do a Fatal 4-Way to crown new women's tag team champions, I would, if it were me, I would want to make that a very big deal. Because it's been many, 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 many years since they've had women's tag team titles in WWE. You have to go back to the days of the Jumping Bomb Angels. And the Jumping Bomb Angels were so awesome back then, I kind of wish, I'm sure they're just long retired by now, but it's too bad we can't get them on the show. But I would make this out to be a very big deal. If you're going to do it, you may as well go all in and make people think that this is just the biggest thing in the world, and everybody wants to be, you know, the quote-unquote first women's tag team champions of the modern era in this company. Whatever that even means anymore. I keep hearing modern era, now I'm using it. So, if it were me, one of the many combinations of matches you could do, I just put this out there as an idea. What about this? Why not make it a four-way match under elimination rules and have the teams as Sasha Banks and Bayley, since it's obvious that whatever they were thinking about doing, splitting them up and feuding, it's not happening now. Sasha and Bayley against Trish and Lita, against Alexa and Mickey, against the Bella Twins. Since the Bellas are still technically members of the SmackDown roster, that's where Nikki is listed anyway, on .com, if you look her up. So at least in that match, you have some representation for the blue brand. But I think that's a big match. Those are well, you know, three out of the four anyway, big teams. I mean, you don't have to like the Bellas, but, you know, to a segment of the audience, they are, you know, to see the Bellas wrestling for the women's tag team titles would be a big deal. And for the people who absolutely hate the Bella Twins, it would be great heat. Right? So you'd have them in there, and especially if they make it all the way to the end with, you know, Sasha and Bayley, or if it comes down to Trish and Lita against Sasha and Bayley. Just imagine the crowd. Now, they're going to be at the Nassau Coliseum, and as somebody who's been to the Nassau Coliseum many times before, I can tell you that that crowd is going to be, it's going to be very hit or miss. I don't know how the crowd is going to be that night. Maybe first time ever, maybe they'll be really excited. I was very surprised when I found out they were going there. Maybe they just thought it would be an easy way to fill the building, you know, keeping it in the New York market, and they didn't want to go back to Barclays so soon after SummerSlam. But the Nassau Coliseum is notorious for having horrible crowds. And so I hope they have some energy this night. And just picture it coming down in an elimination-style match to Sasha and Bayley against the Bellas and the heat that would get, you know, or Sasha and Bayley in there with Trish and Lita, and they kind of have a little standoff, and you pan back, and the crowd's going crazy, and you see the tag titles at ringside. I mean, it could be, you know, a really fun, really, you know, dramatic kind of thing if they wanted it to be. And I think just with the talent in there, it would be a big match. And instead, they could do Ronda defending her championship against Ember Moon. If they want a heel in there, it could be Ruby Riott. Look, I know Ruby Riott is not as big of a name as Nikki Bella, but Ruby Riott has impressed me. Since she has been called up, she has been very good. She has been one of the more impressive NXT call-ups this year. And, you know, she's representing the Riott squad. They've kind of kept them pretty strong as a faction. You could do Ronda and Ruby, if not Ronda and Ember, as the Raw Women's title match. And you can still have all, you could do Charlotte and Becky. I would have Asuka maybe issuing an open challenge. That was the idea I came up with her, you know, for her a few weeks ago. Before she did the comedy BS on TV with Naomi on Tuesday. They could debut a new face from NXT who comes out maybe to accept the challenge, you know? Kairi Sane could defend her NXT women's title. You got the Mae Young Classic Finals. You round out the card with a couple more matches, a Battle Royal, which, you know, you have to do because they're promoting this show as 50 women, right? More than 50 women. You got to have some kind of Battle Royal then to get them all in. So, and there you go, boom, you've got a full card. So there's lots of ways I think they can improve what's written down here, which may not even be legitimate. And I'd love to hear your thoughts too, you know, on at least the top matches. You know, how would you sort of, you know, stack at least the top two, three, four matches on this show? And I think that four-way that I propose for the tag titles, if they are going to debut new titles, you got to make that out to be a big deal. In fact, I would probably close the show out with that. I wouldn't even close it out. I wouldn't give preferential treatment to one brand over the other as far as their women's title. You're crowning new tag team champions for the first time in however many years. You've got star power in that match, like Sasha, Bailey, Trish, Lita, the Bellas. I think that should headline the show. Mae Young Classic, Episode 2, aired this past week. I didn't think this week's episode was as good as the first week. I think it's just a matter of the first round matches generally being shorter, so they save all the really good stuff for the later rounds, which makes sense. Right now, we're just sort of getting to know each one of the women. Deonna Purrazzo and Casey Catanzaro were, to me, the standouts this week on the show. Deonna is really good. She beat Priscilla Presley, Man, that's the first thing I think of whenever I hear the name Priscilla. I think of Priscilla Presley. That would actually be a huge match that should have been promoted a hell of a lot better if Deonna Purrazzo beat Priscilla Presley on the show. Now, she beat Priscilla Kelly, who looks like she could be Paige's little sister, sort of the American version of Paige. Purrazzo has wrestled all over the place the last few years, including Ring of Honor, Impact, Stardom, and even some appearances in NXT. We've seen her on NXT television from time to time, usually being jobbed out to somebody. She was an alternate in last year's Mae Young Classic, talked about how much it devastated her, but this year she finally made it into the tournament, and she's since been signed to a contract, so she is officially with WWE now. She looked great in this match, and she won with the Fujiwara armbar, which is her specialty. Another woman with an armbar as a finisher. I'm dying for, like a leg lock or something. Like, I remember a time when Vince McMahon thought there were too many Steves in his company. Steve Austin, Steve Blackman, Stevie Richards, Steven Larson. So they changed Steven Regal's name to William. He became William Regal. I wonder at what point they make someone change from an armbar to something else. If for no other reason, to at least protect Ronda's finish. But, you know, you got Ronda, you got Becky. Anyway, we had Xeoxys, a luchador from AAA and CMLL. Xeoxys against Ariel Monroe. Monroe calls herself the Big Swole. She is the wife of the reigning cruiserweight champion, Cedric Alexander, and has more charisma than I think I have ever seen in her husband in his entire career. They showed him at ringside with their daughter looking on. She's got a lot of personality, a lot of spunk. She was, again, it's a short match. We didn't get to see too much of her, but she was a lot of fun to watch, though, for the time that she was out there. And early on, Xeoxys was pulling on her hair. And she's very protective of her due. And the building got very quiet, and Ariel just said, and you could hear everything she said, and she just says to Xeoxys, she says, "You touch my hair again, you're going to get popped in the mouth." And everybody cheered. I just loved her personality. Her wrestling was really not all that great. But that may just be the inexperience. She's only been wrestling about 3 years. You know, Xeoxys, she's been wrestling for over a decade. So that's a pretty big gap. And Xeoxys won with the top rope Spanish fly. And it took the air right out of the crowd. Took the air out of me, too. They kept talking about Cedric and they showed him. And I just thought that, you know, Mama was going to get the win. And she didn't. And it sort of bummed everybody out. But then they showed Cedric at ringside with their kid, and the kid was crying when the match was, I don't know why I find that funny. The kid was crying when the match was over. I guess I kind of like it when, not when kids cry, but just, you know, there was a time when that would have been me, when I believed, and I would have been, crying, right? You know, probably if somebody had done something horrible to Hulk Hogan, and I would have written a little letter to him from one of his little Hulkamaniacs, you know, wishing him well and to come back soon and defeat the mighty Earthquake. Not that I did that or anything. Casey Catanzaro of American Ninja Warrior fame makes her in-ring WWE debut here, television debut against Reyna Gonzalez. Reyna Gonzalez was in last year's Mae Young Classic. She lost to Nicole Savoy in the very first round. So it's bad enough that she didn't make it out of the first round, but you lost to Nicole Savoy, who most fans now would say, who? At least if you lost to somebody who went on to become a star, that would have been something. But you lost to somebody who nobody probably has even heard of since. And so she did not want to go into this match losing again in the first round. Casey, from the moment that she came out, you talk about American Ninja Warrior and how athletic she is. She has a very unique ring entrance that I cannot honestly say that I've ever seen before, where she scaled the ring post into the ring, as opposed to, you know, just climbing through the ropes or rolling in underneath the rope, the bottom rope. I guess that would have been too easy. She was like Spider-Woman out there, scaling the post. Has there ever been a Spider-Woman, by the way? I was wondering about that. I'd be surprised if there wasn't, but I don't know. When I went through my comic book phase and my whole Marvel phase where I was collecting cards and holograms and all that shit when I was a kid, I don't remember Spider-Woman being a thing. I mean, I know there's Wonder Woman. I know there's Batgirl. I don't know if there's been a Spider-Woman. So maybe she could be the first. But this was David versus Goliath here. The size difference here between these two was just comical. Catanzaro went for a head scissors, and Gonzalez just turned it into a tilt-a-whirl backbreaker and punished her for a good part of the match. In the end, though, Catanzaro got the pin off of a cradle. So it was one of those sort of flash pins, shock wins. But she got the win, and Gonzalez was very upset. She came back. It looked like she was going to attack Casey. Instead, she shook her hand. She put her up on her shoulder and was parading around the ring with her like she had just got done watching WrestleMania 10 when they did the same thing with Bret Hart at the very end of the show. So, look, she's very green. She's very inexperienced. She's very, very new to this. But I think Catanzaro has absolute star potential just written all over her. She comes off as just incredibly likable, which of course means that the week after she debuts on the main roster, Vince will turn her heel. We had Mercedes Martinez in the main event against Ashley Rain. Ashley is Madison Rain from Impact Wrestling. Ashley Madison, that's funny. She's also Mrs. Josh Matthews. And in the last 2 months, she has wrestled for the Knockouts title at Slammiversary. That same weekend, she wrestled for the Women of Honor title in Ring of Honor. She wrestled in the women's four-way match at All In. And now here she is in the Mae Young Classic. So that's a pretty impressive little... I was going to call it a trifecta, but that's four. So what would that be called? A quad something, I guess? I don't fucking know. But anyway, it's very impressive that she has made the rounds in the last 2 months the way that she has. And Mercedes Martinez was in last year's Mae Young Classic. She lost to Shayna Baszler all the way. She made it to the semifinals before she got put to sleep. She's got almost 20 years of experience, which aside from Mako and maybe Io Shirai, I don't know when Io made her debut, but aside from maybe one or two other women in this tournament, I don't see how anybody could have this level of experience that Mercedes Martinez has. And she's still going strong. I really didn't think that Madison Rain looked all that good here in this match. And I know she's better, you know, than she displayed here. I just didn't think this was really... I don't know. I mean, she just didn't look all that great to me in this match. I was surprised that she also didn't get much of a reaction coming out. Because, you know, all those years she spent in Florida, in that very state, wrestling for TNA, you would think she would have gotten a bigger reaction, and she didn't. Mercedes held her up at one point well over 10 seconds for the old British Bulldog delayed vertical suplex. Ashley hit a roll of the dice for a near fall, and Martinez won with the Fisherman Buster. Decent main event. There really was no one match that stood out this week the way it did the first week, and I think we still have another couple of weeks, I believe, before we see Io Shirai, which I'm very much looking forward to. Her and Toni Storm, of course. We have yet to see Toni Storm here in this tournament. And by advancing, Mercedes faces Mako Satomura in the very next round of the tournament. And you know what that means. It's Mako time.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Some quick NXT notes. No more silent entrance for Tommaso Ciampa. They have given him new theme music by CFOs called No One Will Survive, which sounds like a decent little song. Not as good as the boos and hatred from the crowd, But I guess maybe they figured at some point that would die down, and then his entrance wouldn't be so cool anymore if he wasn't getting as much of a reaction. But anyway, it's up now on the WWE Music YouTube channel. I don't know how I feel about this, though. You know, the beginning of the song has the pulse beat from Taz's old theme song. And then it goes into sort of the, I don't know, generic rock that you would expect from CFOs. I am going to miss, though, the silent entrance for Tommaso Ciampa, who actually, one of the first things he said when he came out, he did reference the music, and he said that that new entrance music is everyone's cue to shut the hell up. And he talked about, you know, the rumors about him having attacked Aleister Black, and he said, as much as I would have loved to, somebody beat me to the punch. And he's as curious as anybody about who that person is, but he would love to shake their hand and congratulate them on a job well done. And apparently the new gimmick with Ciampa is that his championship belt talks to him. So he said the title belt spoke to him, and he offered to translate. He said the belt thanked him for once again bringing it back to the main event, which I thought was just a fucking great line. And it's so true, because when Aleister Black was champion, there were a bunch of takeover shows where he couldn't even, as champion, headline to save his life. It was always Gargano and Ciampa. They headlined two or three different takeover main events together. So I thought that line was great. And then, of course, he ended with his new tagline, which is that if you want to win, follow the lead of Tommaso Ciampa. And there was nobody came out, you know, Gargano didn't come out. I really think they got to keep Gargano just away from him now for, at least a few months, and then they could revisit it and have the big win at WrestleMania, you know, WrestleMania weekend. But Velveteen Dream beat Johnny Gargano a couple weeks ago, or maybe it was last week. It's so hard, all these shows just run together, there's so many of them. I think it was last week. To me, that makes him the new number one contender. And if that means a babyface turn, you know, I don't know, but there was no Velveteen Dream this week. I would assume at some point soon, it would make sense for him to come out and lay claim to being the number one contender. We had Lars Sullivan beating Raul Mendoza, the same Raul Mendoza that he just obliterated a few weeks ago. It was supposed to be EC3 against Raul Mendoza. EC3 is out hurt with a possible concussion, so they had Lars come out and he just beat the crap out of him. This was more of an actual match. Even though it was still mostly a squash. I have to say this, I love the silhouette entrance for Sullivan where he stands in the ring and they just have that silhouette. That is such an awesome shot. Whoever came up with that deserves a bonus. That is just such a cool entrance. The rest of this, it was what you would expect. You know, Mendoza is there to get destroyed, and that's exactly what happened. We got some interviews, pre-recorded interviews separately with Pete Dunne, the UK champion, and Ricochet, the North American champion. They're going to be having a match this Wednesday, champion versus champion. There was no mention of it being title for title. It may be, because they've been talking about how each of them want the other's belt. But right now, it's just being billed as champion versus champion. I have to assume that it ends with an Undisputed Era run-in. I just don't see there being any sort of conclusive finish to this. William Regal interviewed Cassius Ohno. Cassius Ohno barged into his office unannounced as he was wrapping up an interview with Kairi Sane for the investigation into who attacked Aleister Black. I would love for it to be Kairi Sane. Oh my God. But anyway, so Cassius comes in. He's like, don't you want to interview me? And Regal said, well, no, I don't have to interview you. I think he said because Kairi just alibied you. And this upset Cassius very much. He's like, oh, I'm not even significant enough for you to interview me. You're interviewing heavy machinery, but you're not going to interview me. And he was just being very, very irritable, very aggressive here. He's got a bit of an attitude about him. And he was telling Regal that, you know, you bring in your new playboys here and I will wipe them out. Again, it looks as though they're going for, a Matt Riddle Cassius Ohno match at some point, probably as Riddle's first match, maybe at the next TakeOver show. That seems anyway to be the direction they're going in. But it also very much, almost maybe too much, seemed like they were leaning in the direction of heel Cassius Ohno. I mean, look, I said that he was the guy that I looked at as being the person likeliest to have attacked Aleister Black. And I don't know if he's going to end up being revealed as that person or not. Maybe not, if they're going to go with him and Riddle. because I don't think Alistair's going to be out that much longer. I would think he'll be back in time to have a match at the next TakeOver show, so it may not be, you know, Cassius Ohno. But this is definitely leading to an attitude change, which is sorely needed because he has been overlooked. You look at the storylines, he has been overlooked. There is no buzz around him the way that there was a lot of other people. And so he should feel the way that he feels, much as, you know, Becky Lynch. You can understand why, you know, she would be upset about Charlotte being inserted into the match at SummerSlam and Charlotte getting the win. Again, it's completely stupid to think that the fans would boo her because they like her so much. Cassius doesn't have that luxury. I think people would boo him willingly, and it looks like that's the direction that they're going in. Main event was Nikki Cross against Bianca Belair. Bianca Belair is undefeated, even though this match ended in a double countout. That does not count as a, I guess technically that does not count as a first loss, because she was on Twitter saying, I'm still undefeated, I'm still 8-0 on television. And as I and many other people tweeted to her, do not let Vince McMahon know about this. That is the worst thing you could do. So they had a match, and actually a pretty fun match. There was one pretty brutal looking bump. They were outside the ring. And Nikki, you know, does this thing where she just very wildly jumps on your back. She did that with Bianca. And Bianca just fell backwards onto the steel grate, onto the ramp. So that looked like it sucked for Nikki Cross. But they were both laid out dead. They got counted out. Wild brawl after the match was over. Referees trying to pull them apart. They brawled over to where the announce desk was. And Bianca threw Nikki over the announce desk. Nikki got on top of the announce desk, wiped everybody out, referees and all, including the female referee, with a giant crossbody, and that is how they went off the show. So I would like to see more from Bianca Belair and Nikki Cross. That was a fun way, I thought, to end the show. Hopefully not the last we see of those two together. Lucha Underground. Very quick overview here. Didn't really feel like too much happened this week, but they are setting up for a three-way for the Lucha Underground Championship next week between Pentagon Dark, Mil Muertes, and King Cuerno, which sounds like that should be an excellent match. On this show, though, there was a number one contenders match with Mil Muertes and King Cuerno, went to a no decision, double DQ. That's when Antonio Cueto came out, made the match, the championship match for the following week, a three-way. We had the Gift of the Gods Championship was defended this week with Dragon Azteca Jr. successfully defending against Ivelisse. And after the match, Joey Ryan and Exolicious came out, and Exolicious said, look, you've got some experience being part of three ways. Ooh la la. And he basically said, why don't you join us and we'll go for the trios titles? And Ivelisse said, sure, I'm in. And actually, it's funny because that's one of my favorite things, or was one of my favorite things about Lucha Underground. I was a big fan of the combination of Ivelisse, Son of Havoc, and Angelico. And when Angelico got hurt, I was very disappointed. So this could be fun, seeing Ivelisse back in trios competition. Before the main event, which was a trios title match, it was the Reptile Tribe defending against the Super Friends, Phoenix, Drago, and Aerostar, the newly reanimated Phoenix. Before the match, Jack Swagger, Jake Strong, call him whatever the fuck, he came out. He just an immediate channel changer for me. It took everything for me not to just mute this or just change, turn it off. I can't stand seeing him in Lucha Underground. He's so boring. He's so dull. He comes out, he's on the mic, I'll face, the winners all by myself, I'll snap your ankles because I can and I'm strong, shut the fuck up. Anyway, we had a trios title match. Phoenix is all kinds of fucked up, from the time travel and being brought back to life by Aerostar. And Aerostar, he said that this might happen. And Phoenix has not been quite right since he has been reanimated here. He's got the dead eyes, there's something wrong with this guy. And it's kind of like what Doc Brown said in Back to the Future. You go back in time and you start changing things, you could screw up the whole space-time continuum. And I think that's what's happened here. Or in Ghostbusters. Remember what Egon said? Don't cross the streams. Someone crossed the streams with Phoenix. And look what's happened. So anyway, they're having a match. And, Phoenix is, he tags in. And does some of his usual spots, but acting very strangely. And then we get to the end, and Aerostar is coming off the ropes. He's about to do like a big dive out onto everybody on the outside. And as he comes off the ropes, Phoenix hits him with a huge kick, just a huge super kick, and then hits a Phoenix driver. And what's his name? Solid Snake over here. Jeremiah Snake. He goes and gets Aerostar up. He hits the get out of here, as he calls it. Gets the pin. The Reptile Tribe retain their titles. And when the match is over, Melissa Santos goes over to Phoenix. This is her boyfriend here. And she's like, what's wrong? You know, this is not you. And Phoenix shoves her to the ground. He shoved her on her ass. And everybody was just very confused by his behavior here. And Dragon Azteca came out to help her up. And I guess, you know, I would have to assume that's going to lead to a Gift of the Gods title match at some point between Dragon Azteca and Phoenix. And if I'm them, I put the title on Phoenix. I was surprised they put the title on Dragon Azteca in the first place. But the moment he came out on this show and said, I'm going to be a fighting champion, I'm going to be putting my title up on the line, and I'm not going to, you know, basically cash in until the final show, Ultima Lucha, I said, this guy's losing the title. And this new sort of evil heel Phoenix, I think, would be the perfect person to take the title from him. Show closed out with a segment in Antonio Cueto's office. Marty the Moth showed up, and he put down a whole wad of cash and said, I hear that my sister got a Gift of the Gods title match for this. And so he got himself a Gift of the Gods championship match, I think, next week against Dragon Azteca. Then he put down more cash. He said, I got something else I want from you. And that's how they left things. They left it with a little cliffhanger there. What else does Marty want? Does he want a Lucha Underground championship match? Is that what he wants? Does he want Raw to go back to 2 hours? What does he want? So that was Lucha Underground this week. Shockingly, no murders. That's actually a good week. Nobody was killed this week. Let's get to your mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in, although there was somebody this week who did not. But I'll use their question anyway. But please include that information. We have an audio question to start with here from a friend of the podcast.
Solomonster, it's me, Noah the Mark. You know, I think there's a lot of similarities between what's happening to Braun Strowman right now and what happened to Ryback. I mean, think about it. Both very big guys, rock music, coming out with similar catchphrases, feed me more, get these hands. And the WWE has other plans for the championship. It's a case of bad timing, but, you know, the WWE created these stars, so it's their fault, I would say. Either way, do you think Braun is plateauing like Ryback and he's just going to go downhill from there and never rise up, never get that championship, just like Ryback? What do you think?
I think Braun either wins the title tonight or I don't think he wins it. And, you know, he doesn't necessarily need the title to stay over or to, you know, stay a big star, but if he loses, if he starts to consistently lose, which is what happened with Ryback, I mean, you know, with Ryback, they had lightning in a bottle with that guy, and he started losing. And then he couldn't buy a win on pay-per-view for something like 5 or 6 straight shows, pay-per-view shows, he couldn't win. And then he hit the wall known as John Cena, but I mean, by that point, they had already turned him heel, and he was done. We're now in the same point, the same boat with Braun Strowman. A person the fans were genuinely behind. He got over, right? Or organically. They turned him, in this case, because they already have their guy in Roman Reigns. Where does that leave Braun Strowman? So I think it's, you know, the story has not been told yet. We're not there yet. I see the same similarities that you do. I think you bring up a great point, and that worries me. I think if you're a Braun Strowman fan, you should probably be worried that he doesn't turn into the next Ryback. And Ryback is just, in a lot of ways, he's sort of in his own little world there. I'm not comparing them in any way here other than their push up to this point in the company and sort of how they're being used. I think that Braun will always be a great asset to this company, but I think for his sake, honestly, once this whole thing plays out with Roman, and look, if he wins the championship tonight, great. But if not, once this thing with Roman is sort of over, maybe SmackDown, you know, in the next shakeup, SmackDown might be a better place for him. And he might have a chance to sort of win the championship there. And then you can have, you know, people chasing him for the title on that brand. He'd have a fresh set of opponents to get in the ring with. Maybe a change of scenery would not be the worst idea for Braun Strowman. Travis in the Bronx, do you think it's a positive thing that WWE is moving 205 Live to Wednesdays before NXT? It's too early to tell. It doesn't mean anything if they're still taping the show after SmackDown and not before it. I mean, you're still going to get tons of people who leave early, who don't react as loudly because they already saw the show they came to see. I mean, it's like when I went to go see that Hall & Oates concert and I had to sit through 90 minutes of Train first. Had Train gone on after Hall & Oates, I would have been out of there so fast you would have seen one of those cartoon dust clouds behind me, right? Like, if they taped the show before SmackDown, it's a positive move. And they haven't announced that yet. WWE, all they've announced is that, as of this week, 205 Live is moving to 7 o'clock Eastern on Wednesdays. They said nothing about when the show is being taped or anything like that. And people are joking, well, then you can't call it 205 Live anymore. Is it just 205? Which would be very confusing from a time point of view. I would not advise them to change the name of the show to 205. They could call it 205 Live. It really doesn't matter at this point. But if they keep the taping where it is after SmackDown and they just air it the next day, it makes no difference at all. It makes no difference. And it may only be temporary anyway. I think the only reason they're moving it is because of this new Mix Match Challenge. They now have season 2 of the Mix Match Challenge that's about to begin this week. Last year, the episodes that aired on Facebook, they were 20 minutes each. Now they're going to be 30 minutes. They've actually expanded it out a little bit longer. And so they felt the need, I guess, to move 205 Live to a different day so it wasn't airing so late. Now when the Mix Match Challenge is over, they may well move the show back to Tuesdays, unless it does so much better, you know, and they could track these things on the network. If there's more people watching it on Wednesdays, then they can keep it where it is. But what it does do, I will say this, what it does do, it creates what I think is the best 3-hour block of wrestling on television all week now. 205 Live leads into NXT, which leads into the Mae Young Classic, back to back to back. That's a lot of good wrestling in one night. Sean in Fresno, California. WWE posted another ridiculous Instagram post this week, ranking The Undertaker's 5 greatest rivals, with Triple H in the number one spot. Not sure how you can even consider him number one, when to my knowledge, he's never even beaten The Undertaker in a one-on-one match. Do you agree with this ranking? And when you answer no, how would you rank Taker's top 5? Sean can see into the future. He knew I was going to say no. I do disagree with the list, but again, they got what they wanted. The more emotional you get, the more money they make and the more traffic they get. That's why they do these stupid lists. But I'll bite, since you asked. I'll bite. You know, now, look, Triple H is no more Undertaker's best rival than The Shield is the greatest faction of all time. You know, I ran through all the factions last week. In fact, I looked this up, and this just goes to show you why they do these lists and why they shouldn't be taken too seriously. WWE.com did a list of The Undertaker's 15 greatest rivals 5 years ago. And they had Kane at number 1, and Triple H was all the way down the list at number 6, behind Stone Cold. So again, it is not a WWE list so much as it is a WWE social media employees list. So let's just not forget that fact. And I figured, since I did my own version of the top 10 greatest factions of all time last week, and that was kind of fun, and everybody got to chime in on it on YouTube, and everybody had their own list. And thank you, by the way, for all the feedback I got to that. I figure, why don't we do the same here with The Undertaker and his 5 greatest rivals? I'm going to rank what I think, or who I think, are The Undertaker's 5 greatest rivals from number 5 all the way down to number 1. Now, WWE's list, for those of you who didn't see it, they had Brock Lesnar at number 5. Mankind at number 4, Kane at number 3, Shawn Michaels at number 2, and Triple H at number 1. And this is all to promote the match in Australia with Undertaker and Triple H. It's the only reason he's in that spot. My list, I would have Triple H on my list, but I would have Triple H on my list at number 5. I would do the inverse. he goes from first to worst, although he would still be in my top 5. I do think he's earned that spot. I really like the match they had at WrestleMania 17. even though WWE likes to pretend that it never happened and it doesn't really get talked about. But I really liked that match a lot. So they feuded for a little bit going into that match. Undertaker won, and then they sort of moved on from there. Their match at WrestleMania 27, rather, 10 years later, was also really good. Not as good as the matches that he had with Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania, but a very good match. And I thought the Hell in a Cell match that they had at WrestleMania 28 was also very good, although I think people overrate that match. I think that is an overrated match by a lot of people. But it was still very good. So, Triple H at number 5. I have Brock Lesnar at number 4. Compared to everybody else on the list, Undertaker has very few wins over Brock Lesnar. I can't say he has no wins, but he has very few wins. In fact, the only one I could think of is SummerSlam 2015. And even in that match, Undertaker tapped out. If you remember, the referee didn't see it. Then he kicked Brock in the dick and he got the win. There may have been another random win on television many years ago during Brock's first run on SmackDown. I can't remember exactly when or what it was. I'll bet most people probably don't. So here's a guy who's had win after win after win over The Undertaker, dating all the way back to 2002. They had that excellent Hell in a Cell match. They had the WrestleMania 30 match, which was the opposite of excellent, but historically is one of the most famous matches now in the history of that company, where Brock ended the streak. The SummerSlam match I mentioned in 2015 that Undertaker won led to another Hell in a Cell match that Brock won. I mean, this guy had the Undertaker's number. So in terms of rivals, I don't know how you can do a top five list and not have Brock Lesnar on that list. They had him at number 5. I put Brock at number 4. Number 3. Now here's where the list, some people may start disagreeing with some of these picks, but number 3 on the list is Kane. A lot of you are probably going to go higher with Kane. A lot of you probably have him at number 1. I have him at number 3. The Undertaker-Kane story from the beginning was great. It was this great story back in 97, 98, and they built it up for so long. Paul Bearer first coming out and saying, your brother is alive, and they milked that thing for months before Kane even made his first appearance. And when he did make his first appearance, what a first appearance it was. You know, we have a Hell in a Cell pay-per-view tonight, and still to this day, I would argue that the greatest Hell in a Cell match in history, and you know, the Undertaker Mankind one in 98, it's so hard to rank that match. It's more of a spectacle than anything else. I still say as a match, the greatest Hell in a Cell match was Shawn Michaels and the Undertaker at Bad Blood. But on that show, Kane made his debut. He ripped the door off the hinges, and it's still, to me, the greatest debut in the history of WWE that anybody has ever made. So back then, the feud was great. They revisited the feud again many years later in 2010. It was decidedly not as good. They never really had what I would consider to be any classic matches, but, you know, an Undertaker-Kane feud was never really meant to be about work rate, so I don't really know that you can grade it that way. But I like to think back, you know, if this guy's one of his greatest rivals, surely there must be that one classic bout they had. And I really, you know, the WrestleMania match was good. Wasn't great. They had the Inferno match. Yeah, they've had a bunch of matches over the years, but nothing that really stands out to me. They got two WrestleMania matches out of it. They got the one in WrestleMania 14, obviously, was their first. But then again, WrestleMania 20, when Undertaker came back as the Dead Man. It is a classic feud. I just happen to think that the Undertaker had two other rivals that were better. Case in point, the guy I have at number 2, Shawn Michaels. Two of the greatest matches in company history. Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker at Bad Blood in 97, and Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker at WrestleMania 25. The greatest WrestleMania match of all time. The stories going into both of those WrestleMania matches were excellent, especially the second one, with Shawn just obsessing over having to beat The Undertaker, and then Undertaker being the one to put him down and end his career. A retirement that so far, and it may change soon, but a retirement that up to this point has been honored by Shawn Michaels. He has not come back since. I was a big fan of their feud in late 97. They had both been in the company by that point for a very long time, but had never worked a program together, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. But when they finally revisited their feud all those many years later, in the second half of Sean's career, it was everything that pro wrestling should be. It lived up, because for years I said, why are they not feuding Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker? Shawn came back in 2002, and every year that would go by, I was like, this is a big match. Why are they not doing it? Why are they not doing it at WrestleMania? It took them, you know, whatever it was, seven years it took them. But they finally did it, and it was like pro wrestling magic when they finally did. Now, I would not have an issue if on your list you ranked Shawn at number one. That's how good that feud was between the two of them. They were that good together. And then there's the number one spot. And I've said this before. My opinion has not changed. My opinion has not evolved over time. The Undertaker's greatest rival is Mankind. Never has another character come onto the scene and dominated The Undertaker the way that Mankind did. From the very first night he debuted in the company, and I guess you could probably say Kane, because even Kane, from the moment he debuted, he went right after The Undertaker, great debut, Undertaker wouldn't fight his brother, and Kane just, you know, fits the bill also. So this is what I mean. We can quibble about the top spots here. I think you can make an argument for all of these guys. But I just think back to when Mankind, he was the first, even before Kane, he was the first to come onto the scene and just dominate The Undertaker. The very first night he debuted on Raw, the night after WrestleMania 12, he attacks The Undertaker and lays him out. Their first match together at the King of the Ring in 96, he beats The Undertaker. Their Boiler Room Brawl at SummerSlam, he beats The Undertaker. And the matches they had together, it brought The Undertaker out of the mothballs, for me, as a fan. You know, he was cool and all, but really up to that point, what kind of matches was he having? A lot of plotting big man matches against Mabel and King Kong Bundy and Yokozuna. Although I have to say I enjoyed that feud. That's like a guilty pleasure of mine, the Undertaker-Yokozuna stuff. And then along came Mick Foley, in the best shape physically of his adult life, maybe his entire life, giving the Undertaker some of the best, most memorable matches of his entire career. I loved that Boiler Room Brawl they had back in 96. It was so unique. Even the Buried Alive match, again, a very unique stipulation that I frankly would like to see them bring back every now and then. I don't know who you put in those matches, but I thought it was a very unique match. You know, you brawl all over the building. There's no rules, and the only way to win is to throw your opponent in a dirt hole and put dirt on top of them. So they had these brawls and these specialty matches that we had never seen before. Then they revisited the feud. They went away from it. They did have a match, actually, at Survivor Series. That was when Undertaker, he dressed up as Batman. Remember when he lowered from the ceiling? And then they brought the Executioner in, and it got very silly. But they revisited the feud in 97 after WrestleMania when The Undertaker won the championship. They had that wild match, if you remember it, that pay-per-view called Revenge of the Taker. That was the match where Foley got knocked off the apron. He went headfirst, took a headfirst dive, not onto the announce table, headfirst through the announce table. And then, of course, the following year came the Hell in a Cell match. Love it or hate it. It will go down as the craziest match in WWE history. Craziest match I've ever seen. And I was saying earlier, you know, for those of you who haven't seen it, you owe it to yourself to go on their YouTube channel or WWE.com, watch that little 15-minute mini documentary they did talking about the Hell in a Cell match, comments from Foley, phone interview comments from The Undertaker out of character, and some of the other people who were there that night. It's a great piece of business. Everybody should watch it. You know, I can't really do it justice to put into words what it was like watching that match live. And I know we have a lot of people who I know listen to the show who are very young and or who were not watching wrestling at that time. And they only know of wrestling in WWE from the PG era, John Cena, Roman Reigns. I feel so bad for them. But it's hard to put into words what it was like watching that match live. I remember watching it live. I was watching it with my dad, and when that first dive off the cage happened, We had the same reaction, I'm sure, that everybody else did. And we were glued to the television for the rest of that match. And, you know, to see him come back and climb back up the cage for the second bump. You know, in many ways, it was the perfect blow-off to their feud. You know, Bret Hart and Jerry Lawler had a long feud over the 2 years that it lasted, kind of like Undertaker and Foley. Lawler attacked Bret at the King of the Ring in 93. 2 years later, they paid it off at the King of the Ring, same show, in a Kiss My Foot match. And then Lawler sent his evil dentist in to extract revenge. You see what I did there? And actually, the evil dentist turned out to be Kane. See, look at this, 6 degrees of separation here. Anyway, Kiss My Foot match, really? Lame. Fucking lame. But from King of the Ring 96 to King of the Ring 98, same thing. Personal feud. They got away from it for a while, like they did with Bret and Lawler. They went and did other things, but they came back to it. And 2 years later, at the King of the Ring, they blow it off inside Hell in a Cell. If you're going to blow off a feud, that's the way to do it. The Undertaker and Mankind. Their legacies in this company will forever be intertwined because of that match. But it sort of overshadows the feud that led up to it. And some of the other great matches they had. It wasn't just one Hell in a Cell match. They had a whole feud with a bunch of great matches even before that. And just how much more exciting I think it was to watch The Undertaker coming off, you know, frankly, just a ton of lame, boring feuds in the early to mid-90s. Yeah, there were some good ones in there, but there were a lot of real stinkers, too. In Mankind, The Undertaker found an equal for the very first time. After Mankind came Kane, but Mankind was the first. Both guys brought out the best of each other in the ring. Mankind is Undertaker's greatest rival. Period. End of story. Now, two other names worth mentioning. I have them down at 6 and 7 on my list. I guess honorable mentions as far as Undertaker's greatest rivals. Stone Cold Steve Austin and Edge. Austin and Undertaker had some classic matches themselves back during the Attitude Era. And even right before, I guess, what would be considered the beginning of the Attitude Era, they had some matches. When you think of, like, Attitude Era feuds, obviously you think of Austin McMahon, you think of Austin Rock and Triple H, but also Austin and The Undertaker. I'm a big fan of their Fully Loaded First Blood match they had back in July of 99. They also had what is still, to this day, the highest rated WWE match ever on cable television from Raw the month before that match. That match did like a 9.5 rating. I mean, like almost 11 million people watched either all or part of that match. It just is, you know, when I think back on that now and just the way things are now with the television and the ratings and stuff, it is unbelievable. It is unbelievable. I mean, it just shows how things have changed, right? Because this company now is making more money in so many different ways, making more money than it ever has before. And yet you look at the numbers back then, the share, the percentage of people watching their show at any given moment when that show was at its peak of popularity. And now you watch and it's like, wow, it just feels like a completely different world back then. But it was so much fun and it was the in thing to watch. And Austin and Undertaker had a lot to do with that. So their feud was pretty big. And then you have Edge. Edge also had a memorable feud with The Undertaker in 2008. I think in many ways it helped put... I guess Edge was already put on the map by the stuff with Cena. I would say if anything put him on the map as far as a headliner, it would have been that. And Mick Foley played a role. The match they had at WrestleMania 22, you know, him and Edge. But the feud with Undertaker, I mean, it gave Edge his one and only WrestleMania main event. WrestleMania 24, and they had a very good match on that show. So for Edge, it was a huge, you know, a huge deal for his career. And I think out of it, Undertaker got a lot of really good matches. So that's how I would round it off if I, you know, had to put a couple more names on the list. But yeah, in terms of Undertaker's greatest rivals, I think Undertaker is, or Mankind rather, is number one. But yeah, let me know what you think. What does your list look like? Who do you think is the Undertaker's greatest rival? Jad from London, England. My question concerns the infamous Edge Matt Hardy Lita love triangle of 2005. We all know the details of how this ruined the relationship between Matt and Lita. Seemingly, a lot of people backstage sided with Matt, and apparently, in some cases, completely alienated Edge and Lita. I also recently watched a YouTube video where it was insinuated that Triple H was so furious at the situation that he wanted Edge to be fired. The way I see it, given how Triple H's own relationship with China deteriorated because of his affair with Stephanie McMahon, this seems like the pot calling the kettle black. To your knowledge, is there any truth to this story? I've heard that too. It's never been confirmed. It's been one of those urban myths for many years. I always got the sense that Edge was very happy to go from Raw to SmackDown when he did and get the hell away from Triple H. And it worked out better for his career that he did, because he was able to have, you know, the brand all to himself, right? He was the headliner for a while on that SmackDown brand and got a few world titles out of it. And I doubt that would have played out the same way if he would have been on Raw with Triple H for all those years, just because I don't think he would have ever been positioned above Triple H on that show. Triple H would never have allowed that. It's just like AJ Styles right now on SmackDown. He's been WWE champion for almost a year. You think he would have been champion for 6 months if he was on Raw? You think that would have been him beating Roman Reigns in the WrestleMania main event instead of Brock Lesnar for that Universal title, right? So it's a trade-off, but I think it's been good for AJ to be away from Raw for as long as he has. And it's benefited him the way that the move to SmackDown benefited Edge. But as far as Triple H, you know, trying to get him fired, again, it's never been confirmed. I would not be shocked. I would not be surprised. But it's never been confirmed. Ask Triple H. Maybe he'll tell you. The Evolution card has been leaked. Not that I care about this pay-per-view at all, but something has to be done about the leaks. It's the one reason why I stopped watching wrestling. We knew about Bray Wyatt winning the WWE title before Elimination Chamber 2017. We knew about the main event at this year's WrestleMania before last year's WrestleMania even took place. It really ruins the element of surprise. Why hasn't WWE done anything to stop the constant leaks? This person didn't leave a name, so we'll call him Donald. Leaks have always been part of wrestling, right? Going back, I mean, shit, you can go back over 30 years. Early days of the dirt sheets, right? Meltzer may not have been the first, but his newsletter dates back to the early 80s. Wade Keller, The Torch, that goes back to 87. There were wrestling hotlines in the 90s. That became the big thing. You know, the only difference now is the internet. The internet and social media. Everybody has access to everything at any given moment. You know, why do people inside the company leak? I don't know. Only they know. Each person has their own reasons. Sometimes it may be that they're trying to intentionally sabotage somebody they don't like. Or sabotage an idea that maybe they think is really bad. You know, they feel like they're doing some kind of service, maybe. Or maybe they make friends with people and they just do it as a favor to help them. Or to curry favor with certain reporters. So that they don't write bad things or say bad things about them. I don't know what goes through their heads when they leak. And you're never going to be able to stop them. Even if WWE got really paranoid and started tracking their employees' cell phones and all of these crazy things, they'll use a landline, right? Like, people will always find a way. And it's always been the case. You only, you know, kind of feel it more now because we're so connected to everything that all somebody has to do is go post a tweet or a thread on Reddit, call themselves Dolphin Fan, and all of a sudden they're leaking the results of every pay-per-view. Look, you know, when they talk about the odds, the betting odds for pay-per-views, I avoid them because more often than not, the betting odds turn out to be true in the hours before the pay-per-view. Those betting odds come in, somebody from the company is leaking that, and obviously somebody close to the situation because they would have to know what the match outcomes are going to be. And so they leak this information. People make a lot of money off it, which is why it's so stupid, I think, to you know, put too much money down on, you know, betting wrestling. You could bet some money on wrestling as like a fun thing, but you know, I wouldn't bet too much, unless you're, you know, involved in the process and want to make some easy money, I guess. But people have different reasons for leaking, you know. So that's just the way it is. And my advice would be, just like spoilers, which are everywhere. If you really want to avoid them, the best thing to do and the only thing to do is to stay away from wrestling sites and not listen to wrestling shows. And I mean, I don't want you to do that. I want you to keep listening to this show. I think I do a decent job of trying to avoid that kind of stuff, or at least warning you before I talk about it. But if it bothers you so much, it's really the only thing to do. It really is the only solution to the problem, because it's not going away. But like you mentioned, last year, we knew the WrestleMania main event for this year the previous year, that's not a leak, right? I think it was probably pretty obvious what the main event of WrestleMania was going to be. There were people walking out of the stadium last year in Orlando at WrestleMania who knew and were openly talking about what the WrestleMania main event was going to be in 2018. That's not leaks. That's just common sense. That's WWE just being too predictable. That's what that is. So that's going to be it for the mailbag here for this week. We'll cinch this bad boy up. We'll take more of your questions next week. Keep emailing me. Joey Bowie on Twitter asked if I would rank my top 10 greatest WrestleMania endings of all time. After I tweeted this week about how I thought the ending to WrestleMania 10, which I just watched again recently for the first time in a long time, I tweeted how I thought that was one of the greatest WrestleMania endings of all time, which it is. And so anyway, I got this tweet from him, and it got me thinking about it, and I know how much you guys love lists, because I hear about that from you all the time. Can you do a list for this? Can you do rankings for that? And I don't want to start doing it every week, but I figured, you know what? Next week, I will rank what I believe are the 10 best endings to a WrestleMania show of the 34 that we have had so far. I'm going to try to, it's going to be tough because there's been a lot of really good WrestleMania finishes. And again, everybody has their own criteria for what makes a WrestleMania finish great. Is it an isolated thing in a vacuum? Do you have to take into account the fallout and where it leads? I'll come up with my own list and try to rank them. Somebody pointed out that 10, 20, and 30 all had great endings, which they did. Let us hope we don't have to wait until 40 to get another one. So anyway, we'll do that next week on the show and take more of your questions, cover all the latest news of the week, of which I'm sure there will be a lot. Do not forget, the Hell in a Cell review will be up on the YouTube channel. It will be a sound-off extra, as always, exclusive to the YouTube channel. There will be a link in the video description to the MP3. If you do not want to just watch through YouTube, you want to stream it, you want to listen to the audio, put it on your phone, go into the video description. The MP3 link for these things is always there. And hit the subscribe button on the YouTube channel if you have not already done so as we begin our march to 40,000 subs. So until next weekend, be well, stay safe. If you are watching the pay-per-view tonight, enjoy. And I will see you back here tonight for the post-Hell in a Cell review and back here for 565 next weekend. Until next time, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
They have Kane in the back. This is what he said. Tonight, I will delight as I enter the abyss with a fellow monster. But it is I who will climb out alone and with a smile across my face. Oh, oh my God. What do they think this is, Shakespeare? I was driving yesterday and some asshole double parks his car in the service lane. I should have cut a promo the way the WWE would script one out for me. Why art thou parking like one's smelly orifice? I wish 1,000 deaths upon thee. Then I could do a fucking tope and we could fade to commercial.
Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.